Nelson disappoints. Basically, Katznelson argues that even though FDR made a Faustian pact with the worst racist in his party, which is to say, in the country, it was all worth it. Despite FDR's dirty hands, a term that Katznelson defines as taking wrong action in a right cause, he got the New Deal passed. In the end, Katznelson concedes, echoing progressive conventional wisdom on the subject, the same New Deal coalition evolved in a manner that made civil rights legislation possible. So, two cheers for FDR. Had the New Deal ended the Depression, one could make an argument that it constituted harsh medicine that required all sorts of shortcuts and ugly compromises. But it didn't, and as we will see, its long-term effects have been mostly negative. Katznelson's second point about the evolution of the Democratic Party will have to wait for the next chapter. But again, we will discover that the truth is quite different from progressive, conventional wisdom. Shifting the blame. Finally, let's see how FDR reconstructed the Democratic coalition by taking a page, actually two pages, from the early record of the Nazis. First, FDR identified and demonized an internal enemy, rich Republicans, starting with his inaugural address in 1933 and continuing with his 1936 Democratic Party nomination address. FDR castigated wealthy Republicans and conservatives in the same type of language that Hitler used against the Jews, calling Republican businessmen money changers and economic royalists. FDR accused them of creating a new despotism and economic tyranny. The New Deal, in FDR's view, had challenged these privileged princes who sought to oppress political freedom by imposing economic slavery on the American people. "They are unanimous in their hate for me," FDR thundered, "and I welcome their hatred." Only by exposing and routing these greedy swindlers, FDR concluded, could he and his valiant New Dealers create the largest progressive democracy in the world. I am tempted to say that FDR invented the language of class warfare that was then taken up by subsequent generations of Democrats and has now become a staple of progressive politics. In his election campaign of 1948, Truman railed against princes of privilege and bloodsuckers with offices in Wall Street. And today we have the same language from Pelosi, Schumer, Hillary, and Obama. But in truth, FDR didn't invent that language. Hitler did. Sure, we find the same language in Marx and in socialist rhetoric, but let's remember that Hitler too was a socialist. He was the first political leader to actually use such language. FDR was the second. Thus, the class warfare rhetoric of today's progressive Democrats doesn't just go back to FDR, it goes back to the Nazis. FDR recognized, as Hitler did, that envy is a very powerful human force. Its power derives not merely from its sheer wickedness, we detest others for the mere fact that they are more successful than we are, but also from its secrecy. We rarely confess envy to another. "Hey, my neighbor is doing better than I am, and I can't take it." We are reluctant to admit it even to ourselves. Thus, envy is the worst of the deadly sins, even more potent for operating covertly. No politician can openly appeal to envy. Both Hitler and FDR knew they couldn't publicly say, "We cannot stand those Jews and Republicans and entrepreneurs who are smarter and more hardworking than we are. Let's go get them." Consequently, envy has to be mobilized behind the banner of social justice. "Those guys have been stealing from us. It is right and proper that we seize their possessions and distribute them among ourselves." This is the strategy that Hitler and then FDR seized upon. So the point of creating an internal enemy, whether Jews or Republican businessmen, is to justify stealing from that group. But notice how FDR, like Hitler, laid the political groundwork for the theft by accusing his intended victims of being thieves. Hitler had accused the Jews of manipulating the German economy and leeching off the productive labor of the German people. FDR claimed that rich businessmen were tyrannizing the American people and ripping them off. How exactly? Hitler didn't say, and FDR didn't either. Presumably, FDR meant that businesses were not hiring enough people or paying them enough. This was Hitler's usury argument. "The Jews are exploiting you because they are charging too much for their money." But even if this were true, it hardly constituted tyranny. If you don't like what the moneylender is charging, don't borrow from him. In a market system, businesses are not required to hire people any more than people can be forced to work for such businesses. Salaries are settled through a bargaining process involving the mutual consent of the employer and employee. Yet having identified the group from which he extended to extract money, wealthy Republican businessmen, FDR proceeded to build the Democratic coalition to do it. Here we see his technique was very different from that of Hitler and Mussolini. They didn't need to build winning electoral coalitions. FDR did. So how did he do it? Here the progressive narrative focuses on how FDR replaced the Democratic urban machine system of local bosses with a single big boss himself, administering the federal government. I have no quarrel with this narrative. It shows, for example, how FDR worked with the bosses when he needed their support and got rid of them when it was politically safe to do so. In New York, for example, FDR, as a state senator, opposed the Tammany machine. The machine, in retaliation, supported FDR's rival Al Smith for the Democratic nomination in 1932. But when FDR secured the nomination, he made peace with the Tammany sachems because he needed them to campaign for him in the general election. The very next year, however, FDR turned against Tammany once again. He shrewdly allied with the newly elected progressive Republican mayor of New York, Fiorello LaGuardia, and even distributed federal patronage through him, bypassing and thus rendering impotent the Tammany machine. That's how LaGuardia got one of New York's two major airports named after him. FDR could have saved the Tammany machine, Jay Cost writes, but instead, he took the kill shot. In the end, Tammany was doomed, not merely because of FDR's political wiles, but also because the federal government, not the local city treasury, became the source of largesse and Democratic patronage. By the 1940s, the Tammany system had collapsed, replaced with a new patronage operation from Washington, D.C. Yet FDR still needed a mechanism to rally the political support necessary to sustain this patronage system. In other words, to keep Democrats in power. Tammany on the Potomac. He found that support in the unions. Here the progressive account gets romantic and dewy-eyed. Even Katznelson indulges in rhapsodic descriptions of how FDR empowered unions, giving them the power to negotiate with management to get a better deal for workers. Since union membership was voluntary, workers had to vote to start a union, how could anyone deny that this was an arrangement that combined freedom of choice with a more just outcome for workers? I deny it. My basis for doing so is that this was not the arrangement that really matters. Once again, we have to look behind the mask of progressive concealment. The truly significant deal was not the one between unions representing workers and management. Rather, it was the one between unions on the one hand and the Democratic Party on the other. Let's try to see the arrangement from FDR's point of view. Here's the deal that FDR and the Democrats offered the unions. We will pass laws that not only enable unions to exist, but to force workers who don't want to join unions to join them, as long as a majority of workers approves the union. We will also enable unions to collect dues, again from the willing and the unwilling. We will thwart the ability of employers to fire union workers who strike and force them to hire those workers back after the strike. Even more, we will use the government to force management to give in to union demands, in effect, putting the full power of the state behind the unions. What private corporation can resist Uncle Sam? The good news, from the government's point of view, is we don't have to raid the treasury to fund union demands. Rather, we intervene to make the auto industry or the energy industry or the construction industry pay. The government is simply the heavy that beats the private sector into submission. And there's more. We don't want the unions to focus narrowly on worker benefits as they historically have. Now we want them to join with other Democratic groups in pressing for greater welfare benefits, the whole New Deal package. This means that union workers benefit not merely through higher wages and unemployment benefits, but also through more lavish Social Security payments to more lucrative welfare programs. Unions, in short, were given the opportunity to facilitate not merely the ripoff of the employer, but also the ripoff of the taxpayer. It was a good deal for unions. Since nothing in the world is free, however, the Democrats wanted something in exchange for all this federal protection, or to be blunt, for running this extortion racket. They wanted the unions to pressure their members to vote for Democratic candidates, saving politicians the trouble of having to persuade them individually, and to use a significant portion of union dues to fund the campaign war chest of the Democratic Party. This would ensure Democrats could stay in power so the racket could continue indefinitely. Ironically, it was a Tammany man, New York Senator Robert Wagner, and not FDR, who first spotted the potential for a union racket. Wagner sponsored the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which created a pro-union federal board for the purpose of actively intervening in labor disputes. FDR was not actively involved, but Wagner and the unions themselves saw the basis for an alliance that would deliver benefits for the unions and voters and funds for the Democratic Party. The following year, 1936, FDR showed workers what the federal government could do for the unions. The United Auto Workers announced a major strike against General Motors, and in response, GM shut down its huge plant in Flint, Michigan. UAW men then occupied GM facilities, refusing to leave or permit any work to be done there. They also shot at strikebreakers and policemen who sought to remove them from GM property. GM turned to the government for support, but neither Democratic Governor Frank Murphy nor FDR backed the eviction of strikers. Instead, FDR's Labor Secretary Francis Perkins urged GM President Alfred Sloan to come to Washington, D.C. and negotiate with UAW head John Lewis under federal auspices. Sloan declined, saying he could not in good conscience enter into negotiations while GM property was being unlawfully occupied. While the public in general supported Sloan, FDR attacked GM management for its recalcitrance, and finally Sloan, having no federal or state support to recover his property, succumbed to the UAW and agreed to its demands. Soon the entire auto industry got the message that unless they gave in, they were subject to the combined force of the unions in cahoots with the federal government. Not every union embraced FDR at first. The oldest and most powerful union, the American Federation of Labor, remained aloof. But a breakaway group, the newly formed Congress of Industrial Organizations, climbed aboard FDR's bandwagon and endorsed his re-election in 1936. So did the United Mine Workers and Amalgamated Clothing Workers. And once FDR himself got behind the union movement and showed how he could deliver for them, the AFL was soon also on the Democratic team. In sum, the unions went for FDR's deal, and through this union racket, FDR remade the Democratic plantation. And although unions, having provided the political backbone of the Democratic Party for two generations, are now much weaker than they used to be, the racket still continues. In the aftermath of the 2008 crash, for instance, Obama used the power of the government to bludgeon General Motors into making its shareholders and bondholders take a hit, but not its union workers who were shielded by federal protection. The Nazi state didn't need to negotiate with unions. Essentially, it displaced the unions and incorporated worker protections into its own state-run socialist schemes. FDR, however, had to ensure his re-election in 1936, 1940, and 1944. He also wanted to create an enduring national democratic plantation system that would outlast him, and so he did. While the fascist plantations in Europe all collapsed by 1945, FDR's incorporation of fascist ideology and fascist strong-arm tactics into a new democratic plantation system is still with us today. Chapter 8. Civil Rights and Wrongs, LBJ, Nixon, and the Myth of the Southern Strategy. Let's face it, our ass is in a crack. We're gonna have to let this nigger bill pass. Lyndon Johnson to Senator John Stennis, 1957. An interesting phenomenon in politics is the flip-flop. What would cause a politician who takes a stand on an issue to reverse himself or herself and take precisely the opposite stand on the same issue? Even more interesting is the about-face or volte-face. The volte-face goes beyond the flip-flop because it represents a total and usually lasting shift, of course, as when Reagan abandoned the Democratic Party and became a Republican. More interesting even than the volte-face is when a whole group or party makes this shift. Perhaps the most dramatic example in our lifetime is when the Soviet Communist Party in 1991 abolished itself. It's one thing for an individual to undergo a wrenching transformation, but what would cause a whole party to reverse itself in that way? Could it be a transformation of collective conscience or a new perception of group interests or what? Our exploration of the subject is deepened by a new possibility introduced by Winston Churchill, who in one of his essays takes up the subject of consistency in politics. Accused on more than one occasion of reversing himself and taking inconsistent positions on issues, Churchill defends himself by invoking the apparent volte-face, the change of tactics that is not a change of goals or values. Churchill writes, "A statesman in contact with the moving current of events, and anxious to keep the ship on an even keel and steer a steady course, may lean all his weight now on one side and now on the other. His arguments in each case, when contrasted, can be shown to be not only very different in character, but contradictory in spirit and opposite in direction. Yet his object will throughout have remained the same. We cannot call this inconsistency. In fact, it can be claimed to be the truest consistency. The only way a man can remain consistent amid changing circumstances is to change with them while preserving the same dominating purpose." Keeping this in mind, let's examine a series of critical transformations or switches in American politics over the past few decades. Why did blacks who were once uniformly Republican become, as they are now, almost uniformly Democratic? Why did the South, once the solid South of the Democratic Party, become the base of the Republican Party? How did the GOP lose what used to be its base in the Northeast and become the party of the South, the Midwest, and the West, not counting the West Coast? How did Democrats go from their long-standing approach of demonizing blacks to championing black interests and, at least in terms of political rhetoric, demonizing whites? Why did a racist and segregationist like Lyndon Johnson spearhead the enactment of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the landmark legislation of the civil rights movement? No understanding of current politics is possible without answering these questions, and progressives have put forward their answer, which is now conventional wisdom, commonly invoked as if it were too obvious to require any proof. Even some Republicans believe it, as evidenced by RNC Chairman Ken Mellman going before the NAACP in 2005 and apologizing for the racist history of the Republican Party. In 2010, the first black chairman of the RNC, Michael Steele, conceded the GOP's supposed Southern strategy had alienated many minority voters by focusing on the white male vote in the South. You know you've got a powerful ideological indictment when even its targets are willing to make a confession. And what is this indictment? Its essence can be expressed in a few key propositions. The parties switched platforms, at least on the race issue. This big switch was brought about in the late 1960s by the GOP, which under the leadership of Richard Nixon employed an infamous Southern strategy based on an appeal to racism and white supremacy. The racist wing of the Democratic Party, the so-called Dixiecrats, responded by switching allegiances and becoming Republicans. Meanwhile, the Democrats under LBJ pushed through the signature civil rights laws, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Bill of 1968. So the Democrats, once the party of racism, became the party of civil rights, and the GOP, once the party of Lincoln and emancipation, became the new home of bigotry and white supremacy. There is no limit to the number of articles chanting this progressive tune. "The Southern strategy was the original sin that made Donald Trump possible," Jeet Heer writes in the New Republic. Heer contends that while the GOP has relied for decades on coded appeals to racism, or what Heer terms winking racism, Trump with his overt racism is the party's true heir, the beneficiary of the policies the party has pursued for more than half a century. "Reagan, Trump, and the Devil Down South" is the title of a recent article in the left-wing The Guardian, that faults the GOP with making a deal with the devil. Yes, it's the Southern strategy all over again. Goldwater discovered it, Nixon refined it, and Reagan perfected it into the darkest of the modern political dark arts. While these Republicans preferred dog whistle appeals to racism, Trump blows it out, and that's why the base loves him. He feels their rage. And from The Atlantic, we get the headline, How Trump Remixed the Republican Southern Strategy. Here the author, Robert Jones, blames the Southern strategy on the speeches of Richard Nixon, who polished George Wallace's overtly racist appeals for mainstream use in the Republican campaign playbook. Jones, too, says that Trump has upped the ante. In a demonstration of just how successful the old strategy was, he's discarded the dog whistle in favor of a bullhorn. And again, just to highlight the omnipresence of this stuff, we have Solon informing us that the idea that today's Democratic Party is the party of militant white supremacy is profoundly wrong. Why? You see, there was a Southern strategy and a big switch. White Southern Democrats were explicit about their racism, and it's no mystery that they left the party. These people then joined a Republican Party waiting with open arms. There is a considerable body of progressive scholarly literature behind this rhetoric. This includes Earl and Merle Black's The Rise of Southern Republicans and Dan Carter's From George Wallace to Newt Gingrich, Race and the Conservative Counterrevolution. These are the progressive spinmeisters of the narrative of the Southern strategy and the big switch. Most recently, historian Kevin Cruz's study White Flight, Atlanta and the Making of Modern Conservatism, invokes the Southern strategy and the big switch to make the case that white supremacy is now a core doctrine of the Republican right. What dividends this explanation provides for progressive Democrats? Basically, it erases most of their history and gives them a get-out-of-jail-free card. Democrats have never publicly admitted their role over nearly two centuries of being the party of slavery, segregation, Jim Crow, racial terrorism, the Ku Klux Klan, and also fascism and Nazism. Yet, when pushed up against the wall with the mountain of evidence provided in this book, how can they deny it? They cannot deny it. Therefore, their ultimate fallback, their only fallback, is to insist that they changed. The bad guys became the good guys. The biggest payoff for them is the corollary to this. Supposedly, the Republicans also changed in the opposite direction. The good guys became the bad guys. So now the Democratic left not only gets to accuse Trump, conservatives, and Republicans of being the party of racism, they also get to take their own history of white supremacy with all its horrid images of slavery, lynching, and concentration camps and foist it on the Republican right. But is it true? Or, as you are entitled to suspect by now, is the whole doctrine of the LBJ moral transformation and the Southern strategy and the big switch yet another case of progressive deception? More than that, is it an elaborate cover-up for yet another democratic scheme of exploitation, which is to say, yet another modification of the progressive plantation? We've covered the role of two of the most prominent progressives, the pedantic bigot Woodrow Wilson and the quasi-fascist dissembler FDR. Here I give you the untold story of the third one, LBJ, who happens to be the most cynical conniver of them all. And the real question about LBJ is not how and when he made his conversion, he didn't, but rather why an old-time segregationist bigot would become convinced that it was in his and his party's interest to promote a landmark civil rights act. The plot thickens. How does a racist change his spots? We begin with LBJ because he was the man in the White House who drove the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. He was a man of the South who lived through the transformation of the two parties. Moreover, he himself embodied the big switch. He was a progressive racist who appears to have become a progressive anti-racist. He was a Democratic bad guy who became a Democratic good guy. My wife, Debbie, graduated from the university LBJ went to, Texas State University in San Marcos, and LBJ is regarded there as a sort of demigod. On the campus, I walked across LBJ Street to the LBJ Student Center and across the way past a statue of LBJ in the quad. Antifa and Black Lives Matter activists wouldn't dream of yanking down LBJ statues. That's because the progressive narrative on LBJ is even more positive than it is on FDR, at least as far as race is concerned. LBJ was the flawed giant in the title of a biography by historian Robert Dalek. Marshall Frady, in the New York Review of Books, affectionately calls him the big guy and revels in his brawling, uncontainable aliveness, his galumphing conviviality. The story that Dalek and other progressives tell about LBJ goes like this. He used to be a sort of racist given his dirt-poor Texas Hill Country background. LBJ's story, however, is a triumphant account of how a redneck white country boy underwent a moral transformation. To paraphrase Obama, the arc of his life bent toward justice. When he got the power, he used it for good. According to the left-wing journalist Bill Moyers, LBJ once told him that as a consequence of supporting civil rights laws, we just delivered the South to the Republican Party for a long time to come. This seems so altruistic on the part of a famously cynical man as to almost inspire wonder. And as progressives tell it, the political transformation of the Democratic Party was no less altruistic and wondrous. That's because in miniature, the progressive narrative about LBJ mirrors the progressive narrative of the Democratic Party. As the narrative goes, civil rights was no less of a political risk for a party previously wedded to white supremacy than it was for LBJ. Yet the Democrats were up to the challenge and came out better for it. For LBJ as for the Democrats, an unfortunate start led to a happy ending. This account of LBJ is unbelievable and fantastic, by which I mean it cannot be believed and is the product of fantasy. Biographer Robert Caro found in LBJ a hunger for power in its most naked form, for power not to improve the lives of others but to manipulate and dominate them, to bend them to his will. Is it really plausible that this sort of man, whom historian Doris Kearns Goodwin termed the greatest political bargainer of them all, a man who once said he thought about the subject of politics for 18 hours a day, would bargain away his party's interests and get nothing in return for a long time to come? If such strange behavior was indeed the result of a wrenching transformation, there is no plausible evidence for it. Not from Dalek, not from Goodwin, not even from biographer Robert Caro, who seems to have followed LBJ's life virtually day by day for decades and wrote a 4-volume biography of him. LBJ told no one of his great conversion. He never wrote about it or made a speech about it, so if it happened, he kept it entirely to himself. Here is a man who, according to a memo filed by FBI agent William Brannigan, seems to have been in the Ku Klux Klan. This memo was only revealed in recent months with the release of the JFK files. Progressive media, even progressive historians, have largely ignored it, trying to pretend it does not exist. Brannigan cites a source with direct knowledge, even though he does not name his source. As one blogger notes, no one with even a cursory knowledge of LBJ's background can regard his involvement with the KKK to be a shock or a surprise. So how does a Klansman change his spots and become a moral idealist without telling anyone? Moreover, it seems difficult to credit moral idealism to a manifestly dishonest man. Here my exhibit is LBJ's 1965 address at Howard University, which progressives celebrate because in it, LBJ makes a bold defense of affirmative action. You do not take a man who for years has been hobbled by chains, liberate him, bring him to the starting line of a race saying you are free to compete with all the others, and still believe you have been fair. We seek not just freedom but opportunity. Not just legal equity, but human ability. Not just equality as a theory, but equality as a right and result. Impressive stuff as far as it goes, but how far does it really go? The merits of LBJ's argument have been debated ever since by the left and the right, but what typically goes unnoticed is LBJ's telling silence on why blacks were so long hobbled by chains, and who it was that hobbled them. Let's recall that here we have a longtime Southern segregationist giving an account of the sins of segregation in the third person as if he were a mere observer, not a participant. Even so, Dalek's only comment about LBJ's Howard address is that, in retrospect, it seems excessively hopeful, as if LBJ's only problem was an excess of moral idealism. The progressive historian Ira Katznelson, one of the few to notice LBJ's sly omission of his own role in the events he was describing, nevertheless downplays its significance by noting of LBJ, his personal record and sense of pride were at odds with the quality of his history. In short, he lied. Katznelson adds that LBJ missed the chance to come to terms with the most dismal, even exploitative aspects of the New Deal. This, he frets, must have been particularly agonizing for him. I don't know whether to regard this as naive or sneaky on Katznelson's part. Surely Katznelson is smart enough to know LBJ had not the slightest intention of fessing up that he was a member of the racist group that hobbled blacks. If he had, his audience would have immediately recognized that the very dude who poisoned the waters was now hypocritically pretending to show up as the water commissioner. Finally, by every account, LBJ was a nasty, bullying, crude, selfish, mean-spirited, and personally and sexually abusive individual. These are not qualities that we associate with a moral exemplar undergoing a crisis of conscience. There was the time he gave dictation to a female secretary while urinating in a corner wash basin. In the account of a Senate aide on another occasion while sitting next to a woman in his car with his wife Lady Bird on his other side, Johnson made a point of placing one of his hands under the woman's skirt and was having a big time right there in front of Lady Bird. There is much, much more in this vein in Caro's biography. I don't need to go into LBJ's serial infidelities, even in the Oval Office, his chronic boasting about the women he had conquered, the name that he gave to his penis, his boasting about its size, and so on. Suffice to say that Johnson would not survive 5 minutes of scrutiny by the Me Too movement. LBJ, like JFK and Bill Clinton, reflects the priapic aggression of the prototypical plantation boss. Yet, even more than the other two, he liked to lord it over people. Not just women, but everyone. As Caro shows on page after page, LBJ derived pleasure from degrading and humiliating others. He was known to converse with aides in his office bathroom while emptying his bowels, which Marshall Frady interprets as a sign of his Rabelaisian earthiness, but which less charitably reveals an ugly demonstration of his power over subordinates. LBJ was a pervert in every sense of the word. If I can pursue the excremental theme, he was into this shit. As LBJ himself put it, he wanted the type of person working for him who will kiss my ass in Macy's window and stand up and say, "Boy, wasn't that sweet?" Surely many Democratic plantation bosses of the 19th century could have said pretty much the same thing. These traits do not describe the old LBJ prior to some moral transformation. This is who LBJ was the whole time. And the same is true of LBJ's racism. We can see this in LBJ's use of the term nigger or uppity nigger. LBJ didn't just use these terms in the early days when, under the tutelage of his segregationist mentor Richard Russell, he upheld segregation and the poll tax and fought to undermine anti-lynching laws. No, LBJ showed a special fondness for them when he was Senate leader, vice president, and president. In other words, the very time he was supposedly undergoing his moral transformation. In the mid-1960s, LBJ nominated African-American lawyer Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court. When an aide suggested to LBJ that there were other qualified black jurists he could have chosen, suggesting as an alternative Judge A. Leon Higginbotham, LBJ responded, "The only two people who ever heard of Judge Higginbotham are you and his mama. When I appoint a nigger to the court, I want everyone to know he's a nigger." This was in 1965, 1 year after LBJ helped secure the passage of the Civil Rights Act. The man he called a nigger was the nation's most prominent African-American attorney who had argued the landmark 1954 Brown versus Board of Education case. Yet progressive historian Robert Dalek, who recounts this episode, interprets it in a way to minimize LBJ's culpability. Johnson's pejorative language was partly his way of intimidating a new staff member or of showing how tough and demanding he was. Yet for LBJ, this kind of talk was a consistent pattern. The same year, LBJ told his aide Joseph Califano that the black riots in the Watts area of Los Angeles showed how blacks could not control themselves. Pretty soon, Johnson warned, "Negroes will end up pissing in the aisles of the Senate or making fools of themselves the way they had after the Civil War and during Reconstruction." The very fact that LBJ continued to embrace this view of Reconstruction, once promoted by the progressive racists of the Dunning School and popularized by Thomas Dixon in The Klansman, Birth of a Nation, suggests that contrary to progressive rumor, LBJ's racism was never rehabilitated. Biographer Robert Caro describes an incident involving Robert Parker, LBJ's chauffeur. Parker recalled an occasion when Senator Johnson asked him whether he would prefer to be called boy, nigger, or chief. Parker asked to be called by his name. Johnson erupted. "Let me tell you one thing, nigger. As long as you're black, and you're going to be black till the day you die, no one's going to call you by your goddamn name. So no matter what you are called, nigger, you just let it roll off your back like water, and you'll make it. Just pretend you're a goddamn piece of furniture." Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, in the otherwise positive biography Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream, cites LBJ telling Senator Richard Russell during a debate over the Civil Rights Act of 1957, "These Negroes are getting pretty uppity these days, and that's a problem for us since they've got something they never had before, the political pull to back up their uppityness. Now, we've got to do something about this. We've got to give them a little something, just enough to quiet them down, not enough to make a difference." This admission is telling not merely because of its use of the insulting reference to the uppityness of blacks, but also because it shows that LBJ's support for civil rights legislation wasn't the result of some moral awakening on LBJ's part. Rather, it was part of a strategy. This notion is confirmed by what LBJ allegedly told two governors regarding the Civil Rights Act of 1964. "I'll have them niggers voting Democratic for 200 years. Some progressives, notably the fact-checking site Snopes, have questioned this quotation, which appears in Ronald Kessler's Inside the White House, but not in any other source. Kessler attributes it to Air Force One's steward, Robert McMillan, who claims to have heard LBJ say this. And as we can see, the quotation is consistent with several others whose veracity is undoubted. My conclusion is that LBJ remained the vile, bigoted Democrat he always was, and the notion that he underwent some sort of enlightened conversion is pure humbug. LBJ's shrewd calculation. It's time to reinterpret LBJ's conversion, and to do this, we must try to imagine the political landscape that LBJ saw before him, a landscape very different from the one that FDR encountered a generation earlier. Two big things were changing and fast. First, white racism was declining precipitously all over the country, but especially in the South. Second, blacks were getting up and moving out of the rural South, and many of them were voting for the first time. Both these things were a big problem for the Democratic Party. Let's take them in sequence. As innumerable surveys confirm, white racism, at least racism of the old sort, which is to say, old-fashioned hatred of blacks, holding them to be inferior beings, and sanctioning violence and degrading treatment of them, plummeted throughout the late 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s. So sweeping is the change that many survey questions routinely asked prior to World War II. Are blacks entitled to the same legal rights as whites? Would you consider voting for a black candidate for political office? Are no longer even asked because white support for these things is now nearly universal. Harry Truman saw the change happening even in the late 1940s, and this, not some moral evolution to a higher state of being, was the sea change in American public opinion that pressured him to desegregate the military. LBJ also knew this because he could see it, even in the Texas backcountry. Now, it's tempting to believe that racism declined in America because of the moral suasion of the civil rights movement, but to believe this is to put the cart before the horse, as most progressive accounts predictably do. The reason they do this is so that they can credit LBJ and progressive activism with the civil rights laws, and then credit those laws not only with creating legal equality, but also with combating racism. In reality, however, the steep decline in racism preceded the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement didn't cause it. It caused the civil rights movement. Think about why Martin Luther King Jr. encountered so little intellectual resistance to his challenges to segregation. 50 years earlier, he would have. This is not to deny that local officials like Birmingham Sheriff Bull Connor unleashed dogs and hoses on civil rights protesters. King himself served time as a political prisoner in the Birmingham jail, an experience that strikes a chord with me. But by this time, the intellectual fight had been won. The local segregationist establishment, not King, was on the defensive. That's because popular opinion in America had shifted dramatically between the time FDR died in 1945 and the 1960s. So what caused the shift? The obvious answer is Adolf Hitler. In the end, the horrific crimes of Hitler overthrew the doctrine of white supremacy. Once American troops entered the concentration camps, once people saw those ghostly, emaciated figures emerge out of the camps, they could no longer subscribe to theories of Nordic superiority they might once have held. Those doctrines were now permanently discredited. The progressive historian George Frederickson points out in Racism: A Short History that the very word racism came into common use only in the 1930s, when a new word was required to describe the theories on which the Nazis based their persecution of the Jews. This shows how closely linked racism and Nazism were in the popular mind and helps confirm that it was the Nazis who, against their intentions, of course, finally put white supremacy into the grave. We can imagine that LBJ watched with horror the decline of racism in America, not simply because he was a nasty bigot himself and bigotry loves company, but also because white supremacy had been the central political doctrine of the Democratic Party for at least a century. Once the Republicans ended slavery, the Democrats turned swiftly to white supremacy, which became the glue both in the North and the South that held the party together. With racism dwindling fast, LBJ knew that his party would lose voters, whose allegiance to the Democrats had been based on the party's support for racist policies. This was a serious problem. From the Democratic point of view, it meant that if racism could not be revived, and there was no way to revive it after Nazism, then the party would need new voters, and lots of them, in order to compensate for the loss of white racist voters who are regrettably losing their prejudices. Where to look? There was only one place, black voters. And blacks in the 1950s and 60s were voting in greater numbers than ever before. For the first half of the 20th century, the Democrats had, through racial intimidation and other means, largely suppressed the black vote in the South, where the vast majority of blacks lived. But starting around World War I, a great migration occurred in which blacks over the next several decades literally got up and moved. As Isabel Wilkerson writes in The Warmth of Other Suns, some 6 million blacks, nearly half of the entire black population of the rural South, left the farms, plantations, and cotton fields of that region and moved to cities like New York, Detroit, Chicago, Los Angeles, Philadelphia. Some moved to smaller cities like Milwaukee and Oakland. The Great Migration was, as Wilkerson put it, an unrecognized immigration within this country. Here in the cities, blacks could vote and did vote. So for the first time in American politics, the black vote became significant, particularly so by the late 1940s and 1950s. The black vote was especially important in swing states like Illinois, New York, and Pennsylvania. Fully aware of this, Republicans offered the most sweeping and forceful endorsement of civil rights for blacks to appear in any party platform since the 19th century. The party of Lincoln was making a bid for these black voters. Again, this was a major problem for LBJ and the Democrats. LBJ knew that in order to make up for the racist vote, the Democrats must win not just some black votes, not just a majority of black votes, but virtually all the black votes. The Democrats needed blacks to be just as uniformly loyal to the Democratic Party as white racists had previously been. LBJ had to figure out a way for blacks to vote for the Democratic candidates automatically, habitually, regardless of the qualities or qualifications of the Democrat on the ticket. Plantation confessions. But how to achieve this? After all, Democrats had been segregating, degrading, and abusing blacks for a long time. LBJ knew this as well as anyone else because he had been one of the abusers. How then to convince blacks who were now voting to vote en masse for a party that had enslaved them, segregated them, terrorized them, and was still the party of bigotry in the 1960s? LBJ realized that the Democrats could no longer whip the blacks into submission as in the past. The Democrats needed a new relationship with blacks and on different terms than before. However reluctant LBJ may have been to admit it, we see that reluctance in his statements to fellow Democratic bigots in the Senate, he was also a realist. If he wanted virtually unanimous black support for the Democrats, he knew he couldn't just beat it out of them. He would have to woo them for the first time in the party's history. He would have to make it worthwhile for them to stay on the Democratic plantation. But how? This is a difficult topic to talk about, and I'm about to go into controversial territory. You're thinking, controversial territory? Where else have we been throughout this book? What I mean is that I'm now entering territory that is controversial, even by my standard. I have to tread carefully. I don't know a better way, however, than to illustrate the state of mind of a sizable segment of African Americans in the aftermath of slavery, a state of mind that became critical to LBJ as he attempted to solve his political conundrum. I turn to Eugene Genovese's study of slavery, Roll, Jordan, Roll, widely considered to be the best work on the subject. Genovese relays the testimonies of several slaves who were interviewed after they became free. We might expect them to vividly describe the travails of enslavement, and they did, but they also confessed to something else. I quote verbatim from these accounts. Here's Andrew Goodman, interviewed at the age of 97. I was born in slavery, and I think them days was better for the niggers than the days we see now. One thing was, I was never cold and hungry when my old master lived, and I has been plenty hungry and cold a lot of times since he is gone. But sometimes I think Marse Goodman was the bestest man God made in a long time. The slaves cried when told we were free, 'cause they don't know where to go. And they's always depend on old Marse to look after them. Here's Henry Nicase of Mississippi. To tell the truth, the fact of the business is my master took care of me better and I can take care of myself now. When us was slaves, master tell us what to do. He say, Henry, do this, do that. And us done it. Then us didn't have to think where the next meal coming from or the next pair of shoes or pants. The grub and clothes give us was better'n I ever gets now. Here's Ezra Adams. The slaves on our plantation didn't stop working for old Marster even when they was told they was free. Us didn't want no more freedom than us was getting on our plantation already. Us knowed too well that us was well took care of with plenty of victuals to eat and tight log and board houses to live in. The slaves where I lived knowed after the war that they had abundance of that something called freedom, what they could not eat, wear, and sleep in. Yes, sir, they soon found out that freedom ain't nothing less you got something to live on and a place to call home. This living on liberty is like young folks living on love after they gets married. It just don't work. As an immigrant who came to America with $500 in my pocket and no family here, no connections, nothing to fall back on, I know at least a little what it's like to be flung into freedom. I'm hardly comparing my experience to that of former slaves, but in India, I did see the people known as Dalits or untouchables. These people have historically been treated worse than slaves. They are so reviled that traditional Hindus would not allow their shadow to cross over them. The untouchables, too, fell into a kind of collective stupor in which they could hardly imagine a route of escape from their degraded lot. Based on that experience, I have nothing but sympathy for these poor slaves who had been turned into complete dependence during slavery, and were then hurled into freedom in a society where, to put it mildly, they were not welcome. Thus, I am not criticizing their longing for the security of the old plantation. I am merely recognizing it as a natural and powerful response to their dire situation. LBJ would have recognized it just as I do. The difference is that I get it from books, reinforced by my own admittedly quite different experience. But LBJ grew up in the Texas Hill Country. He was a redneck from the rural backwoods. He knew people like Andrew Goodman, Henry Nicase, and Ezra Adams. He understood their insecurity. He understood their fear, in part because he was helping to create it. And now, years and even decades later, LBJ saw a way to exploit that insecurity and fear to offer blacks a new arrangement. This arrangement became the essence of LBJ's great society. I'm going to put $500 million in this budget for poverty, LBJ told black leader Roger Wilkins, and a good deal of it ought to go to your people. Both LBJ and Wilkins understood that these types of handouts weren't free. They were offered as part of a bargain between LBJ and the Democrats on the one side and the black community on the other. Here is the bargain that LBJ offered African Americans. We Democrats are going to create a new plantation for you, this time in the towns and cities. On these new plantations, unlike on the old ones, you don't have to work. In fact, we would prefer it if you didn't work. We are going to support you through an array of so-called poverty programs and race-based programs. Essentially, we will provide you with lifetime support, just as in the days of slavery. Your job is simply to keep voting us in power so that we can continue to be your caretakers and providers. Here's the part LBJ did not say. We are offering you a living, but it's going to be a pretty meager living. Basically, you get public housing, food stamps, retirement checks every month, and medical care for the poor. If you have children, we will subsidize them, provided they are illegitimate. More than this, we cannot offer you, because we have to make sure that you stay on the plantation. This means that we need you to remain dependent on us so that you keep voting for us. Your dependency is our insurance policy to make sure that this is an exchange, not a giveaway. In sum, LBJ modified the progressive plantation so that blacks, for the first time, would be treated as constituents, much as the Irish were in the Tammany days. No longer would Democrats directly rip off blacks by stealing their labor. Now blacks would become partners with Democrats in a scheme to extract resources from other Americans. Through a variety of taxes, regulations, and mandates, those other Americans would be the ones paying for the Democratic plantation. What made the scheme irresistible from the Democrats' point of view was that through the state, the Democrats could force even Republicans to pay for their new urban plantation. In fact, the very sufferings that Democrats had historically imposed on blacks would now supply the moral capital for demanding that America make blacks whole. Future arguments for reparations and affirmative action would emphasize not what the Democrats did, but what America did. Now the American taxpayer would be on the hook for correcting the wrongs perpetrated by the Democrats. LBJ knew, of course, that not all blacks lived in inner cities. Less than half of African Americans today do, and that was also the case in the mid-60s. It was never LBJ's intention for all blacks to actually inhabit the urban plantation. Rather, he wanted about half to live there, dependent on the government, and the other half to work for the government, serving the urban plantation. These blacks could now be considered overseers of the Democratic plantation. LBJ knew that if the government employed blacks on a large scale, it would draw blacks out of fields like teaching, preaching, and small business. Teachers, pastors, and entrepreneurs would become administrators, service providers, and social workers. In sum, they would lose their skills for succeeding in the private sector and learn only how to administer the agencies of government. They, too, would become captives of a sort, fatally dependent on the Democratic plantation. They, too, would have no way to leave. From the perspective of LBJ's deal, African Americans could now look to the federal government as a new type of big house. LBJ himself would be Massa, although he could be considered a good master as long as blacks lived up to their end of the deal. And LBJ probably genuinely believed it was a good deal for blacks. After all, who else gets a living from cradle to grave without having to work? Even so, shrewd artificer that he was, LBJ must have known that he was making blacks complicit in their own captivity. A captivity no less real for being voluntary. Few would actually have a chance to escape from the Democrats' urban plantation. Some would even learn to love the plantation. Blacks took the deal for the following reasons. First, having come out of the haunting experience of slavery and sharecropping, many of them were terrified of what African-American writer Shelby Steele terms the shock of freedom. To them, a meager security seemed preferable to the risk of not being able to survive. Second, some blacks had come to believe, as some do now, that because of past oppression, America owed them a living. Republicans, of course, know there is some truth to this, which is why, During Reconstruction, Republicans attempted to give blacks a fair start, but were thwarted in these efforts by racist Democrats. Today's Democrats, however, are all too eager to affirm that blacks require the lifetime support of the U.S. government because this then provides the pathway to political dependency on the Democratic Party. One consequence of LBJ's deal was that race, which black leaders from Frederick Douglass to Booker T. Washington to Martin Luther King had been trying to eradicate from public life, took on a new significance. Blacks wanted to be known as black, and black even became beautiful. No one was surprised when progressive pundit Cornel West published a book called Race Matters. As Shelby Steele Riley noted, race never mattered to such people when there was no profit in it for them. Also, as a consequence of LBJ's deal, Democrats became the new champions of blacks voting. From LBJ on, Democrats wouldn't merely advocate that blacks vote, they would in many cases supply the buses to take them to the polls. In a book on the Great Migration, Isabel Wilkerson writes, without irony, "Suddenly the very party and the very apparatus that was ready to kill them if they tried to vote in the South was searching them out and all but carrying them to the polls." If LBJ were around to read this, I'm sure he would have found it hilarious. That's why LBJ converted from a racist Democrat who sought to keep blacks down on the old sharecropping plantation to a racist Democrat who sought to create a new type of plantation where blacks would willingly vote for their Democratic providers. That's why LBJ pushed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and the Great Society. That's why progressives lionize LBJ, even though they know what a vile scumbag he was. He's their guy. He was the creator of their urban plantation in its most modern and most recognizable form. And that's why blacks have become, as a group, the lifetime servile dependents of the Democratic Party. Party of Civil Rights. Despite the ingenuity of LBJ's plantation deal, the Democrats still had a major problem, and LBJ himself had no idea how to solve it. That problem was that blacks have long memories. Even blacks living in the 1960s had parents who endured the slights and humiliations of segregation, grandparents who were sharecroppers, great-grandparents who were slaves on the Democratic plantation. Progressive Democrats realized there was no way to con blacks into forgetting about all this stuff. What they needed was a way to convince blacks that while Democrats may have been their enemies in the past, Democrats were their friends now. Hence, progressives needed to sanitize LBJ sufficiently to give him full credit for the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts. And this project of persuasion would work even better if somehow they could persuade blacks that Republicans, who are blacks' liberators in the past, were their enemies now. In this way, black fear, including the nightmarish memories of the past, could be channeled into political hatred directed at the Republicans. This is the significance of the Southern strategy and big switch arguments. The left needed to make the case to African Americans that the parties switched platforms and switched sides. Somehow, the cops became robbers and the robbers became cops. Consequently, we must never lose sight of how these arguments are weapons to cover up the tracks of the bad guys and to project the blame onto the good guys, making it seem like they are the bad guys. It's naive to consider these arguments apart from their political utility. Still, in the two sections that follow, I'm going to do exactly this. I'm going to examine propositions apart from their manipulative use and merely ask of each one, is it true? Let's start by asking, which party actually passed the landmark civil rights laws of the 1960s, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the Fair Housing Bill? Progressives give full credit to LBJ as if he single-handedly got the legislation through Congress. Yet LBJ knew that the main opposition to these laws didn't come from the Republican Party. It came from the Democratic Party, from the group of racist segregationists, loosely called the Dixiecrats. These Dixiecrats, led by former Klansman Robert Byrd and LBJ's own mentor Richard Russell, mounted filibusters to block the legislation. The filibuster against the Civil Rights Act continued for 83 days. Byrd himself spoke for over 14 hours. LBJ's only way to get the laws passed was to turn to Senate Republican leader Everett Dirksen. Dirksen knew that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was merely a restatement of the 14th Amendment that Republicans had passed and Democrats had turned into a practical nullity a century earlier. Even the whole colorblind doctrine articulated by Martin Luther King was hardly original. Frederick Douglass said the same, and said it better, many decades earlier. In the mid-19th century, Douglass insisted that there was no self-esteem to be found in skin color. Let the sun be proud of its achievement. He added, it is evident that white and black must fall or flourish together. In light of this great truth,